Hello and welcome to another episode of the Student Loan Planner Podcast. Today, we're going to talk about how the state of the student loan servicing industry is broken. And to do that, I've got one of the original members of the Student Loan Mafia, Bobby Mattson, joining us today. Bobby, how's it going?
It's going well, Travis. Pumped to be here.
When I say Student Loan Mafia, I'll just describe what I think of that as. So it was 2018 or 2019 in St. Louis. Do you remember?
I think the first Mafia hang was in 2019.
Yeah. So we were in St. Louis for this conference until like 2019, and it was this like financial advisors conference, and a lot of like key people in the student loan space showed up to that conference randomly. So we had Heather Jarvis, who helped write some of the original rules of the student loan system. We had Jantz Hoffman, who kind of created the CSLP program, which is this kind of extra credential for financial planners that want to know something about student loans. We had you, who you were kind of like the VC-backed kind of like traditional entrepreneur looking for the billion-dollar exit kind of guy. I was there, the mediocre blogger. And then also Megan Landris was there, who at the time was helping out Jantz and Heather with the CSLP. And, you know, she ended up becoming one of our most important hires for as a student loan consultant. So we had all these people and we just nerded out hard. We kind of hung out in like the lobby of one of the folks's executive suites that she had, because it's St. Louis, so executive suites are cheap, and drank a couple cocktails and started talking about how he had fixed the whole student loan servicing, student loan industry, I should say. It was amazing. I really wish I had a mic that I could have recorded that conversation, but alas, we don't. And so that's why I'm having you on the show today. So Bobby, welcome.
Yeah, so pumped to be here. I look back on that moment very fondly. Like, you know, we got to do it again, I guess, post-COVID or when it's safe to. But we should definitely get on the horn with everybody again, because there was the topics we were discussing, like you had to know about all the edge cases and all the random little factoids that no one really talks about in student loans to really understand what the heck was going on in that room.
I know.
So it was just great to have like-minded folks who really cared about borrower outcomes.
One of the games we played is that fraud? Basically, we would just throw out an idea that was super sketchy, like running your own private practice, but operating a quote unquote nonprofit practice out of the same building. And then you're going to charge people less money that are poor and more money that are rich. And all of the poor people get treated through your nonprofit practice, and that gets you PSLF. So that was one of the ideas I brought up. I was like, you know, guys, is this legit or no? And then Jantz very confidently was like, total fraud. Terrible idea. You'll get in trouble. The fines will be enormous. Don't do it. And I was like, oh, snap. Like, okay, this is good. I remember one of our conversations that we had at this conference a couple of years ago. Wow, 3 years ago almost now. Oh my gosh, we're old. Is that you were trying to break into like the student loan servicing business or help them at least in that business. And I was convinced that this is a terrible business that nobody should be involved with. Mm-hmm. So I guess I just want to throw out an idea and get your reaction to it. So servicers get paid, I think it's $25 to $30 per borrower. What kind of incentive structure does that create when you've got a large amount of customers, but you're getting paid only $25 to $30 per year per customer?
One of the things that when I was first talking about, hey, there's a lot of problems in the servicing environment, and you know, I think there's just a lot of things that technology can do to automate some of the processes that humans are handling today and have handled for decades with these complicated programs. The fee structure has improved for servicing, but I feel like servicing is always going to be there in student loans. Like if you're processing payments in a debt vertical, you're going to have servicers, and they're just a functional part of the industry. So improving on processes means there's more borrowers in repayment at less cost if you're able to do that without humans. So what's good about where the fees have gone with servicers is that they're not, originally they were, you know, account focused and more by loan volume. Now they're based on the status of the borrower. So a borrower who's, or a loan, depending on the contract, that's in forbearance or delinquent or deferment, you're going to get less as a servicer than in repayment. So there is a revenue incentive for servicers to get a borrower into active repayment and to be current, which I think that was 2014 or 2015 where those fees were updated, but it's critical and a critical incentive. So that's why the timing for our services, which help improve those servicer ops and produce better borrower outcomes, were well-timed, because servicers are actually incentivized to embrace partners like us.
So before we get into more like fun conversation, can you just explain at a high level what Payitoff, your company is, and where you're at and the whatever you can share in terms of like what y'all have raised and what or what your goals are, you know, how you help mostly institutional customers?
Yeah, definitely. So Payitoff, we automate every aspect of debt management for fintechs and financial institutions, workplace benefit providers, starting with student loans, though. We really started because many, many moons ago, my wife and I had six-figure student loans that kept us from starting a family. You know, one of the things I noticed was as a borrower, I needed that clarity in order to move forward with my life. You know, my background's at working at Groupon, Stitch Fix, Fandango, lots of apps where I was scaling complex decisioning to millions of users. So this felt like a pretty similar type of thing. But I just didn't understand that it was so easy to buy insurance on Lemonade, but so hard to figure out your student loans. And that's when I started codifying the regs and figuring out exactly what our repayment path would look like. We saved tens of thousands. We have a 3.5-year-old. We have a house now. Like, we've been able to move forward with our lives because we had clarity and some level of guidance. What I noticed as going full-time with the company 4.5 years ago was the tooling was really what was missing. Like, there were just wasn't great tooling for the industry. So that's why we're like focused very, very, very much on being a B2B provider in this space. We compete with services like Plaid, who offer connections and aggregated data to loan a borrower's loan accounts. We do very similar user permission to access to accounts, but then a lot more on top of that. Literally, the whole system we built is designed for the borrower to save money because that aligns incentives across the ecosystem. So, you know, we've raised to date $11 million, great investors in fintech, mostly Lightspeed, Sound Ventures. We've also Struck Capital was one of the first investors in 2019 around the time we had our mafia hang. And Social Leverage as well, Lockheed Groom, who's early at Stripe. So a lot of the Stripe, Square execs, those types of folks really understood long-term what needed to be there. And now we're taking the same technology to other debt verticals. But like, student loans is always going to be the most complex, right? It is the most complex debt in existence, and no one's going to convince me otherwise.
Yeah, I mean, I love talking to you because it always makes me feel like I'm some sophisticated Silicon Valley guy when I'm this country bumpkin that's bootstrapping our company and not talking to anybody about capital raising. I'm grateful for that because it does make it so that you can do anything you want to do, right? Yes. That's one real great part about running a business is the only person that can fire me is my wife.
That's so true.
I like to joke about that, but it's like, it's kind of true. Like, that's the only person that can fire me from this business, you know, because she's a part owner, right? So
exactly,
I joke a little bit. But it's true. And it's kind of nice because like when you do raise capital, you know, you do have obviously other people, you have to take their views into account. Obviously, you can help a lot more people a lot faster that way too, right?
That was the decision right there. Because we were bootstrapping. I bootstrapped it for the first 2 years about before we raised money. And honestly, you shouldn't raise money unless you have a growth opportunity. Like, the reality is, if you have like a growth opportunity with a technology that can scale well, and you know how to do that, and there's like a game plan for that, then you're going to align incentives better with the VCs because they need to 10x their portfolio. So that's once you know that that's what they need to do and your company is well suited to do that, then those things can go well. Where it doesn't go well is if like the expectations aren't aligned in terms of what you need to do. You know?
Yeah. Whereas for me, 10xing sounds like I'll need to start taking blood pressure medication.
Exactly.
And 2 or 3xing while I work on hiring great people and not having to fire people that aren't a good fit rapidly,
exactly,
is less stressful. So one thing about financial planning is, what are your goals? Why, you know, how do you get those goals? So that's just something that I like to remind myself of, because I'm always putting pressure on myself, like growth targets and growth goals. And it's like, yep, wait a second, maybe if I'm a dentist that runs a very successful small town private practice that does $1 or 2 million of revenue a year, maybe that's awesome. And maybe just be happy, and that's perfectly fine. And, you know, obviously, if you are somebody who kind of gets a nervous energy, like if you don't try to grow something, then maybe you go open a second or third practice, right?
Yeah.
So I think that there's a lot of different options out there. But I guess if they wanted to raise a bunch of money and become the next Heartland Dental, they could talk to you.
Right. It's different. They're just different. I don't think one's better than the other. Because I just as quickly would have stayed bootstrapping. You know, we were ramen profitable. So I I was sort of getting to that decision. What I noticed is I just felt like for our particular approach, get it maximizing the impact within the applications, because a lot of my background was in APIs and building infrastructure. So I just felt like the skill fit was better for this particular timing, but I was very close to just not raising money and just focusing on the advising tool that we had built for financial planners and, you know, continue to expand that product line, which still is used by dozens of RIAs and, you know, hundreds of advisors. So it's pretty wild to have that as like as now a secondary product line.
Yeah, the interesting thing with Student Loan Planner is like our consult business was our first business and we still operate it. We still take it very seriously, but it's secondary to our advertising business and other businesses. And it's kind of weird, but it's also like the passion project. Like the consult business is like why we exist, is to transform people's lives, right? And then some of the other miscellaneous revenues, it's like nice to have, but it's like, you know, you want to do that core mission driven thing really well. But anyways, for servicing, Navient recently exited the business. They said that they didn't want to be a part of it anymore. I've got some thoughts. But you've got 6 or 7 million borrowers that they're getting $200 million a year for to service, and they don't want that anymore. What are your thoughts as to why Navient wouldn't want $200 million a year?
Yeah, no, I think that must have been a hard decision for the, or maybe not, you know, depending on who you talk to.
I don't think it was. But I want to hear your thought.
I mean, what is that? Like, I think it's like 5 or 6% of their annual revenue or something like that. They were making more money elsewhere, and the costs were tremendous for servicing the ED contract. So the transition to AidVantage is probably one of the smoothest transitions that I've ever seen in terms of borrowers being able to basically access those accounts with the same credentials. The way they managed the handoff, I thought, was pretty crazy good compared to other servicer transitions I've seen. But yeah, 6 million borrowers moving to a new servicer right ahead of a resumption of payments, which was extended, but it was a big undertaking. And I think that Navient in that and FedLoan have FIA have both made it clear that, you know, they don't want to be servicing these specialized programs or the federal loan complexities anymore.
Well, I mean, here's my more unedited take. I think that if I'm looking at a business, I have multiple business lines and I've got a business line that's like 5% of my revenues. I'm looking at that business line and I get sued for it a lot. I get threats of lawsuits about it a lot. I get attacked on social media for it a lot, and I might deserve it. That's the other thing. It's like I might deserve all of these things happening to me. But if I'm looking at all of that, and I have one portion of my business that's taking up a majority of the headaches and the problems,
right?
Get the heck out of that business.
Right.
That is an awful business. Nobody should be in that business. And so them kicking it over to AidVantage, which is a subsidiary of a group, I believe, that runs the defaulted loan portfolio for the government, is kind of, I would say it's a little alarming, because actually, like, I've heard some things from borrowers that say they've had a worse experience so far, particularly when it comes to the website interface, which is probably due to the next gen project moving everybody to the federal website. You know, why would you invest money in your own internal tools if they're going to be eliminated shortly?
Yeah.
So yeah, I think you're looking at it and you're saying, okay, all these costs and legal risks, and, you know, the low income employees had the biggest wage pressure on the upside too in the economy. So you've got all of these lower wage jobs that you have to pay really well to get somebody to take them. And, you know, you're looking at your portfolio and you're looking at the FFL loans, the FFEL loans, you get billions of interest income in those, but those are dying off. So you get into refinancing and private in-school loans to try to make some money there. And you're looking at this servicing as just, yeah, it's good for brand recognition, but it's like this awful business. And so, you know, you get out of it, and essentially, like, the legal decree that they have to follow in terms of giving people advice in PSLF and for not forbearance steering, all these complicated rules that they have to follow as a result of their lawsuits, they can now just follow them for the next couple months and then say never again.
Right.
Right. Which I think is a great business decision for them.
Yeah. One thing we've heard, because we're involved a lot with the Student Loan Servicing Alliance, like Scott Buchanan is an advisor to the company, and we're on a panel with Maximus, who runs AidVantage, that subsidiary, in May, right, at SALSA's annual meeting. One of the biggest questions we got, because with servicers, we're typically engaging saying, like, look, you can gain access to a distribution pool that of borrowers that you're having trouble contacting through these types of networks, like through the Chimes of the world, through the no official relationship there, but through these other avenues where borrowers are living, you can gain access to ones that maybe, you know, you're only trying phone and email that's stale, or maybe address that's stale because someone's moved around a lot. So servicers have serious challenges in contact, especially with at-risk populations. And that also drags huge costs too. So I think you're thinking about it pretty similarly, like just from the high level C-suite level of like, okay, this is killing our brand. One of the biggest questions we got is like, how do we make sure that borrowers know that we're trying to help them and not like after them, you know, because I think that's what they get painted as in the media a lot, you know, and don't get me wrong, servicers have done a lot operationally that didn't help borrowers at all. But they're also being asked to do some pretty wild things from their main client, Ed, for that program. So I think that we're seeing a little bit of the typical thing you'll see in the servicing environment is Ed asks for a change request. They negotiate some work order. They implement it, but it happens too quickly and isn't up to the sort of rates that are SLAs that Ed wants. And then they make a PR mess to those servicers, blaming them for the issue when like, it was kind of set up to fail in some ways in the beginning with some of these. And I'm saying a more generalized thing, but this happens all the time and has been happening since the beginning of student loan servicing is this type of relationship.
But the problem is like, I'm going to say that the politics of student loans now is just brutally cynical.
Oh yeah.
So here's my take. So you've got like conservatives on the right, you know, Republicans that do not want to fund these servicing groups at all. Like they do not want to give a lot of money to provide a lot of resources to help people enroll in income-based payment and forgiveness programs and get more people access to PSLF. That's anathema to what their view is. And so therefore, one of the solutions is underfund the student loan servicers. Now, I'm going to be bipartisan in my criticism here. On the left, with the Democratic side of the aisle, they might have goals of getting more people forgiveness, more people not having to pay on their student loans, more student loan cancellation. And so what you do is, like you said, you sort of create this situation where you wait until 30 days or 40 days or 50 days before the giant job of a payment restart for 42 million customers to decide to extend it yet again, the payment pause, right? While that's good for borrowers in the short run, in the long run, what you're doing is you're creating this absolute nightmare of a mess from the operations side of things, where people, when they do have to make payments again, are going to be so confused, are going to be so turned around, are going to be not knowing what to do. They're going to be calling the servicers who haven't received adequate guidance from the Department of Ed.
Right.
And yet, Democratic Party and then the left, I don't think, care enough about that part of things, about actually making sure that if you are going to ask people to pay student loans, that it is done in an efficient way and, you know, easily. So like one kind of interesting thought process on this is like the Trump administration didn't do anything to help reform the student loan programs, right? The Democratic side of the aisle on reforming student loan programs is let's add another, you know, please, sir, can I have another one more, right? Whatever that Charles Dickens thing is, like, let's make, you know, instead of IBR, let's make the pay program and the repay program and let's make this new EICR plan, right? So it's like both party, I'm trying to say that like both parties are failing student loan borrowers because you've created this system that's got all these really warped incentives, right? So if like Navient talks to me, they want to get me off the phone as fast as possible because if their call length goes up, they got to hire a bunch more people,
right?
And it's even less profitable to them. So I don't know. I don't have any answers here. It's just a big mess.
No, I think that you're pretty on the money in terms of the difference in the political party's influence here. I would say that obviously what I've seen in the resumption is Republicans, you know, in the Senate and elsewhere, more so like, let's get back to normal. Like, let's get back to payments. Like, people can pay. For people that can pay, let's let them pay. And for people that can't, I mean, we're losing, they're saying $5 billion a month, but it's more like 10 when you really do a lot of the math. And it's a lot of money, you know, and honestly, it's a lot of taxpayer money.
But let's point that out, though. How terrible is it that neither party or any of the government's accountants can actually give an accurate estimate as to what it's actually costing? Because everybody cites, what they do is they all cite the interest cost. But guess what? If you're going for PSLF, the interest cost is totally irrelevant.
It's totally irrelevant.
That shouldn't be included in the $5 billion cost. Whereas, like on the flip side, if you're getting paused payments, you know, on your student loans, that cost should be included But it's not, because the government's not able to project who's going to go for forgiveness and who's not, or they're not doing it. And so then that cost doesn't get added in. So you're right. Like we've said, it's about $10 billion a month. Mm-hmm. And you might say, well, why does that matter? Well, the reality is if it comes out of that option, it's going to come out of somewhere else.
That's right.
Either inflation, or maybe, you know, if you're taxing the rich for it, like then that's money that can't be used to fund adequate healthcare investment. So, I mean, I don't know. I don't have great answers here, you know, but I know that the system's pretty screwed up, which is why the servicing is so screwed up.
Yeah. And I do think the things that I see in that, with what you just described, is just a fundamental misunderstanding, even from the Congress, about how student loans work. Like 47% of all borrowers benefit financially from a federal program of some kind. So whether it's PSLF or IDR, like that's something we've done. It's a sample of thousands of borrowers' outcomes. And the remaining, it's around 31% are prepayment, a small portion on refi, roughly 8 or 9%. And then the rest are on the right track or doing the right thing. So that 47%, I mean, even if you just run the math against that, it's like, you know, most of those borrowers are leveraging IDR or PSLF, which, like you mentioned, you don't see those payments again because they count during the forbearance period. So that's cash flow that would have been future. Because again, the interest doesn't matter for even an IDR plan if they get rid of the tax bomb at the end of the IDR period, which is likely going to happen now that they've said it can be forgiven tax-free until 2025. So I think we're just seeing like a lot of confusion. And what ends up happening is it's hard to have oversight on a program that very few people know much about. And we're seeing that across the board. I mean, even just think about like all the student loan app graveyard, if you will. There's so many apps that have come and gone because they came in and they were like, we're going to help this population because it's totally underserved. And then you get in it and you're like, oh my goodness, unless you like intimately know these regulations, it is harrowing, right? It's it's so hard to produce an outcome. And that's because the complexity goes back so far. And I think that's kind of what we're seeing today, is the let's just forgive it reaction on the Democratic side is really, I think, coming from this sense of like, will it ever, like, we just kind of need to do something to give relief.
Well, it's broken.
Right.
I mean, the system's totally broken. So I understand it. Like, I agree with a lot of it, like in the sense of, yeah, the system's broken. So a natural reaction is, well, let's cancel all of it.
Right.
But the problem with that is, well, wait a second, you're not addressing the problem of cost.
Yeah.
You know, because then you're going to have the same problem again in 10 years and you'll have to cancel it again. And you might say, well, will you just do that? Well, then you have to go back to, well, even if you believe that all student loans should be canceled for everyone, even if you're like the most progressive voter in the world, you still will have to care about costs, because those, again, are resources that are not being invested in childcare subsidies or healthcare or other public goods, right?
Exactly.
And so I want to go to the mat for any borrower who can save any dime on any program that exists. Like,
exactly.
That's not what we're attacking here, right? But it's kind of fun to talk about just how screwed up the incentives are, how messed up the programs are. One example I gave on social media recently was attending physicians that became attending physicians in 2018 and 2019, mm-hmm. going for PSLF during this pause. You know, they would have recertified with their residency payments in like 2019-ish, right?
Yep.
And then, you know, the following year, they would maybe, you know, have to use half of the year attending, half the year resident. And then the following year, they'd be certifying with a full attending income.
Mm-hmm.
So those people got paused payments during the pandemic. And then looks like until 2023, in a lot of cases, that's the next time they'll have to recertify using their attending incomes.
Yep.
So for a lot of like subspecialists, like say orthopedic surgery, neurosurgery, my wife's a year gynecologist, this would be true for her, you would be able to basically pay residency payments of like $300 a month during your 5 to 6, 7 years of training. And then for these past 3 or 4 years, at worst, even if payments do start, you're paying, you know, $300 a month until they finally ask you to recertify in 2023. So what's the subsidy? It's like basically, you know, the first year you pay zero, right? And so the first year is zero cost of the 10 years of PSLF.
Mm-hmm.
The pandemic payments were paused for 2 years. So that's another 2 years of zero. So
yep.
You've got 7 years of basically $3,000 per year. So that's $21,000, right?
Mm-hmm.
So it's like, oh, wow, $21,000 paid on your student loans of $200,000 plus as a high income physician.
Right.
And we're going to compare that to what they're asking for of $50,000 of cancellation. you know, which if that happened, that would help single moms. It would help people in default. It would wipe away the debt of like 90% of Americans.
Yeah.
Yet, but we've already canceled like way more than that for people that, again, clients of ours, we love them getting it, right? Mm-hmm. That's not what I'm saying here, but I'm saying from a public policy standpoint, how messed up, how screwed up is that, that you're basically canceling multiples of what you would want to be able to cancel for people who are in that lower income spectrum, really struggling economically. And like the cancellation is definitely happening. It's just sort of disproportionately going to our listeners, which congratulations. Right. I mean, like, I guess the PPP loans disproportionately went to business owners, like people like me. And then when the pandemic, you know, I thought we were going to go out of business. And then when that didn't happen, business owners that got PPP loans were not asked to refund that money. Mm-hmm. If I had been asked, I would have gladly done it, but you know, we didn't. And like, we had a bunch of contractors, so we didn't get very much at all. But people that had a bunch of employees, a lot of cases got six figures that they didn't have to pay back. And it was all tax-free basically, because they got to deduct expenses against their revenues anyway. So they got to double dip. I don't want to have this podcast be like the whole system's, you know, screwed, everything's screwed, but it's just like, this is showing why the student loan problem is so hard, because neither side can fully get its way. And so they sort of do battle with all these like other weapons at their disposal, like the servicing payouts and like the way they do servicing and doing extensions, more extensions versus just straight up cancellation, which might be harder to do legally. And it's just all this big mess.
Well, one of the things that's important to remember for anyone listening is that, you know, when you hear forgiveness, when everyone's like, well, what do you think about forgiveness? And we got asked all the time when we were raising money. Well, one of the things to note is that most of the government's assets are student loans, because that's the way they view it on their balance sheet. So like, it's hard to say that it'll go anywhere, but it could, especially in like a pandemic situation or a national emergency situation. But when anyone asks like, well, what do you think about potentially forgiveness? I'm like, there's hundreds of loan assistance and forgiveness programs today that exist, like across states and across different private, there's even private nursing forgiveness opportunities. Like there's so many niche opportunities that based on where you live or work. And so PSLF being the one we hear about, and temporary expanded PSLF being the other. But you know, there's so many, teacher loan forgiveness isn't far behind it in terms of its opportunity. But there's so many of them. And I think that borrowers just need to know their options, and they don't gain that visibility or that clarity. So from my perspective, I'm of the angle of I'm very optimistic of the system improving if FSA and if the servicing environments continue to embrace better technology to address hard decisions with these complexities. Because the thing is, for any complexity, there's always a solution to making it simpler and easier to understand and digest. The thing is, we need investment in tools like that, tools like ours and others out there that are actually digging into what are the outcomes we can create with technology. I think that's the thing that I'm going to harp on forever, is that I've seen the benefits. I watch the benefits every day with our tool of people saving so much money and businesses operationally being more efficient, just because you're helping more borrowers get into repayment without using a human. I think that's the thing that can actually answer some of these problems, so that everyone's better off, because that's what FSA wants too. Ed wants more borrowers in repayment. Prior to COVID, only if you look at their data, 40% of borrowers were current on their payments. If you literally look at FSA's data, the Ed portfolio, the federally managed portfolio, was 40% current. So it's not like this has always existed as an issue, you know, getting more borrowers into repayment and having them produce better outcomes. It's like just, it's like in the limelight now, but I think that when you're Ed, you're saying, okay, that doctor that's saving 21 grand, they're weighing that against like, hey, we need broader impact here, which I think is why we're seeing targeted relief towards healthcare heroes with PSLF and whatnot. And so you're going to see more of those targeted programs. It's better optically because this has become such a political decision at this point. Like it's very clear that the economy and, you know, the progress we're making with COVID is directly tied to resumption. So the reality is we are in a position right now where there's never been more opportunities for borrowers. And so to me, net, it's good. It doesn't end up being great in the long run for our, you know, I mean, we, when you look at government spending, I don't want to go down that rabbit hole, but like long-term will be great for borrowers because it's just so many new opportunities. Even this PSLF waiver has so many borrowers actually finally getting, for goodness.
They, I mean, they can cancel all student debt and it's like a fraction of what fixing Medicare costs.
Right. Yeah, that's true.
They could absolutely forgive it all. And, you know, I love my mom, but she still doesn't understand that she's getting way more in government benefits from Social Security and Medicare than she paid into the programs, right? And it's like, that's one thing. As young people, we don't get that much of our fair share because we don't vote as much as all the old people do, right? Mm-hmm. I'm joking. We have older listeners, too, for the Student Loan Planner podcast, and we love you, older listeners. So don't hear me saying that in a mean way. I'm saying it in a loving, joking way. So a couple thoughts, like with what you said. I was listening to NPR this morning and they talked about how Delaware had eliminated like the worst cancer disparity in the nation. And what they realized is like people that speak a different language besides English were getting confronted with cancer treatments and had all these appointments to schedule, all of this bureaucracy to handle, all of these complicated medical bills they were getting, and they were having to do all this in a culture and language that was unfamiliar to them. Mm-hmm. So that was one of the reasons that was literally causing people to get treatments later, having worse outcomes. It was causing much higher deaths in these underrepresented communities. And so the state hired like a healthcare navigator to help them get through the bureaucracy and sort of show where to go to book appointments and how to handle the medical bills. And like, they didn't even realize a lot of things would be covered with no insurance card. Like, so they could do all these things for them that were super helpful. And so I kind of think of you guys as kind of like that. You're kind of helping all those loan forgiveness programs that you mentioned, helping people access those. But the problem is when you create a complicated system like the student loan setup, what happens is you increase disparities because people that have the income who are disproportionately overrepresented, right? Hire groups like ours, hire Student Loan Planner to save them tens of thousands of dollars for a few hundred dollars, whereas people that are more disadvantaged groups might not do that in the same numbers. And so then you create these big disparities in outcomes. And I feel like that's kind of what happens. If you look at the default statistics for African-Americans, you know, Latino community, Native Americans, like all the, you know, first generation, like all these different ways you slice it, default statistics are just way higher in these communities. And it doesn't make sense because you have income-based repayment. But this thing is the system's so complicated and it's not set up to be friendly for borrowers. It's set up because of this maze of incentives that exists. And so you get all these issues. But I mean, I do think both of us are working on fixing that problem. I mean, I do think that, like, not to sound self-serving, but we help a lot more people that don't pay us anything than people that pay us something. Because a lot of people go to our site, find resources. Some of our most popular articles ever were things like on how to reverse your tax refund getting seized, which are, you know, are people that are low income, that are struggling, that will get their tax refund instead of have it seized by the Department of Ed, which is great. So I don't know. I'm not sure if I have a point in there, Bobby. I'm just
I think
riffing.
I like your analogy because I think of our company that way. I think of technology that way, where you're able to serve populations in a way that could be profitable or at least like scale. There's a reason that the audience for Student Loan Planner that you can consult with human-to-human is like a higher balance bracket where you can actually do a lot of impact and there's a formula there that's profitable. But that doesn't really work as well for even outside of Student Loan Planner for any financial services company to access a population that maybe has 50 grand in student loans, you know, because they have very similar problems. If you have 100K in student loans, you make 50K a year. That's just as bad as, you know, making 250K a year and having 500K in student loans, right? It's just the outcome is much greater in your financial picture in terms of like the breadth of it. But you're still talking about very similar mental battles to understanding what you're dealing with and less access to the resources to actually make it happen. So I completely like agree that the system's set up to create these disparities, even though those programs are meant for communities that need them, right? It's just the access that matters. And what's funny, I say access, but like that was the point of student loans in the first place. Student loans, like the original like doc for the vision of student loans in the 50s and 60s were all focused on greater access to education. So, you know, it's amazing to me that now we're talking about access to forgiveness options from those student loans. You know, I think that that's kind of come all 180 on that in terms of, you know, these rising costs of tuition. I mean, I'm looking at it now. People, I look at forecasting for 529s and I laugh because it's like, oh, you need to save $1 million to send Mila to school. And I'm like, yeah, right. I do. Like, are you kidding me? I know that prices will increase, but you're using this insane tuition hike that we've seen for 20 years and applying it for the next 20. It's just totally unrealistic. You know, people are going to learn differently.
We had a state 529 executive on the podcast recently, and she mentioned that their max account size limit is like 550,000. So that's mm-hmm. like they're what they're expecting people will have to spend for undergrad plus grad school.
Wow.
I mean, it was just, at least they allow people to say that much. So I thought that was kind of crazy.
That's wild.
So let's talk about what people can expect for the next few years.
Mm-hmm.
So in 2019, we were talking about the next gen servicing contract, and that was one of the hot topics in 2019. And then the world blew up and that totally got shelved and put on the back burner. Then from the ashes, there were a series of servicers chosen during the Trump administration's Department of Education. You know, I like to say suspiciously, MOHELA, which is like the Missouri version of FedLoan, and then Ed Financial, which is like a Knoxville, Tennessee company, which are happening to be states that were Tennessee is the guy that used to run the higher education committee in the Senate. Mm-hmm. And then the number three guy in the Senate was from Missouri. So I wonder if that was like connected in any way. But anyways, these five companies got chosen to be the new servicers, but they're going to only handle like the operational and call center responsibilities. Mm-hmm. And all of the stuff that matters is going to go through the Student Aid website. Can you talk about that? Explain what borrowers are going to see that's different. Explain if borrowers are ever going to need to go visit the servicers' websites in the future. Like, what's coming down the pipeline?
Yeah, so it's funny because back in 2018, April 2018, we actually responded to the RFP for NextGen back then.
Request for proposal.
Yeah, request for proposal. I remember going to Kinko's and submitting, printing out 15 binders and submitting them with like CDs and like all the stuff that Ed wanted to see. Because we were a year, almost year old startup doing that. And it was like us and Scratch Servicing. We were the only two startups that did it. Anyway, in that process, it was important for us to see the requirements that Ed had for servicers and to gain access to all the ways that they expected certain things to happen, whether it was IDR, whether it was all these other programs, whether it was how they expected costs to work. And so I could share it with you. It was our original proposal. It's like 40 or 50 pages long that discusses basically the vision of a servicing environment, what types of technologies you can use, how you can use them to scale it, how you can make these complex decisions simple. A lot of these things now we've built, it's kind of cool to look back on and to see NextGen come back in sort of its third form. I think that was really the second go at it in 2018. What typically ends up happening, though, is these contracts come out, servicers get defensive. Well, not defensive. They get competitive. And it's usually not fair. There's usually some bias in the process that they claim and then kind of drag it along. I don't have as much visibility into the reasons for all those things happening. But, you know, there were lawsuits and things that kind of dragged the process along. Those contracts you mentioned were for business process operations contracts, BPOs. And those folks have really, you know, de-scoped throughout the pandemic, like what they were awarded. But now that we see this RFI, which is a request for information, it's actually due tomorrow. We're submitting a response to it. They're saying, okay, well, we know that building our own system from scratch is a massive undertaking that will take a long time. So what's kind of good to see in this is that FSA is saying we don't want to throw out all the years of experience here. You know, they're really focused. I mean, they even say it in the actual doc that while they want it to be a consistent brand and have FSA more involved in the servicing function, you know, they're not seeking to like purchase or build a single platform to service accounts. So I think that's actually a good thing to see because it will promote more competition, which can help, but also oversight so that FSA has more control over things that they've needed or wanted control over. And it creates less of this situation where they're blaming servicers for everything because it'll be all in the FSA ecosystem to some degree. They're calling it the USDS contract. And so that's really going to be I guess there's still a lot to be determined here, but you may be able to say log in with your FSA ID when you go to Aidvantage's website or whichever servicer you're interacting with. There's just basically going to be more, and they even discuss creating APIs for servicers between FSA and the servicers more directly. So there's a lot of opportunity here if their goal is getting more borrowers in repayment and providing better access to data and just a better view on like what's happening in a borrower's life. When they link two servicers accounts, those servicers aren't talking to each other. So you really don't have any sort of communication thread between them, which I think this could help with, where you actually have visibility between those accounts. And we have lots of ideas that I think could really help Ed in navigating some of this, just because we've been building APIs for years and, you know, well, really know how that could work.
I'm going to be negative Nancy here. And I'm thinking it's going to be just a failure, you know, not an abysmal failure, just like it's just not going to help that much. Because what I think is going to happen is, like, I was just thinking about the incentive structure for student loan planner versus mm-hmm. them.
Yep.
So if we do a great job for our clients, they refer friends and they tell other people about Student Loan Planner podcast. They tell people about our website. They tell people to get on our email list, and we get more customers, and then we get more consultants that we hire to service those customers. And then that begets more and more people as we grow. Whereas the servicers are being given a customer list. Hey, go service these people. And here is your fixed price that you will be paid to do this. So if Department of Ed has a great idea and they want to hop on the phone with me and talk about an API integration that they could hire you for, or they're going to do some sort of initiative on the website to integrate something, make things simpler, anything like that, I'm not interested if I'm one of these company execs, because I want to maximize profits for these 5 or 10 years that I'm contracted through the department, with the knowledge that there's a good chance that I'll be kept around in some capacity because I'll be too big and too involved in the process to be taken out. Right? Like, this is like my undergrad econ mm-hmm. thing. So for that and 50 cents, you can, I guess you used to be able to buy a Coke. Now you can buy like a piece of gum, but you know, inflation, hashtag inflation, but you have to fix the incentive structure. You know, mm-hmm. if you don't fix the incentive structure, in my opinion, servicing will never improve, because mm-hmm. all you can do is just threaten somebody. And it's like empty threats. If you threaten Navient and Fed Loan enough, guess what? They leave.
Right.
And now you're stuck with a call center of people that have zero experience, and you're going to have even more problems as these people get trained up and learn the ropes of what they're doing, right? I have very little confidence in it. I do think it's nice that they're going to have one website and one portal, if you will, to go through to do things. Like, that part's good to me.
Mm-hmm.
You know, or trying to simplify the back-end processing, like, that makes sense. But if you do that, you also create an incentive for the servicers to say, okay, in between then and now, I'm not going to invest anything in my website. I'm not going to care at all where the buttons are and try to improve the user experience or try to fix things. You know, I'm just going to leave it alone and just try to maximize profits.
I think what they're trying to do in this, though, is to take these targeted programs that are expensive for servicers and move them into the FSA brand. We've seen some of the percolations of that. Like, you're seeing that you can process your IDR apps on FSA, studentaid.gov, and there's a PSLF help tool that's improved a lot. But then they also have the STOP Act, Stop Student Loan Scams Act, that prevents third-party access or user permissioned access to those accounts. So what you're going to see is, like, a Plaid or us isn't going to be able to do that unless we go through the department to register the access device. So, like, you will find, like, a lot of interruption possibly if this happens, because you'll have, think about how many people are paying, getting monthly contributions from their employers, millions of borrowers that are going to have service interruptions if this happens. But I am confident that Ed's thinking about that. I do agree with you, though, in the sense of, like, this system is so complex that the first thing I think is, well, most borrowers have some kind of private loan, right? So they're going to have, what, two logins when they go, like, you know, like, so it starts to get complex when you start just thinking about the average borrower's experience. If I have to log in to FSA, like, to Advantage with my FSA ID, you know, or Nelnet, what about my private loans with Nelnet? Or what about my, you know, like, there's, it's not, they're thinking about the federal portfolio, but there's a greater context that a borrower is going through, which is why we think the more you can promote access and securely to the federal loan system, the more you can get more borrowers in repayment, because you have vetted actors in the ecosystem that can watch out for scams, that can be incentivized to help reduce fraud or mistakes or, you know, interest capitalization when it shouldn't happen. Like, I do think there's a way to introduce that structure is kind of what I'm saying, but we're a long way away from it. Like, they're talking about, like, end of 2023 or something. for some of this, and it feels tight given what they're talking about. But they've moved pretty fast with a lot of things through this situation with PSLF and others. So I don't know.
Let's close out by blaming Congress, which is always a popular thing to do. We'll blame both parties in Congress. So all these new plans, why did they all exist? Well, it's because IBR is statutory. Congress passed that in a law, and Congress passed new IBR, which is supposed to like update the old one to make it more generous, to make it kind of like pay. But then because of just the waiting times and the lack of ability to agree on legislation, the executive branch has added all these other stuff, all these other programs in there, right? And so this latest rulemaking, like that was going on to make another IBR program, they were doing it because they can't get Congress to agree on anything. Mm-hmm. And Department of Ed, the negotiators made a great point. They basically said, well, why not make like one plan that's like so much more generous that everybody would switch to it? And the answer to that is like, well, if you can't get that done in Congress, the next time Republicans control both houses of Congress and the White House, at some point, if that happens, then they would just come back and do the same regulatory process and try to tighten everything down, make it a lot less generous. And you got to get Congress to pass a law, in other words. Otherwise, you're forced with the current regulatory structures to just add layer upon layer upon layer and make it more and more complex, which is, I guess, why we both have businesses, right?
Yeah.
So, I mean, certainly we hope things improve. We hope people will get the cancellation they need. We hope that servicing will improve. But instead of, what's the opposite of cautiously optimistic? Cautiously cynical?
Yeah, I feel like we've had good cop, bad cop on the student
It's good. I mean, it's a good thing. It's a good thing we got going here.
I was going to say one other thing, which is I think we could help that a lot. And this is something I've been thinking about, just getting more involved with Capitol Hill on, is educating senators on how federal loans work. I mean, I think at the end of the day, they have broad understanding. They see so many things, though, right? They're voting on a million things, especially in the House. Right. So, like, you know, I wouldn't expect them to have intimate knowledge, you know, especially as there's new folks that come in and out over the years. What I do want to say is that federal loans are not like they are not private loans. Like they are not like fixed payment loans that you're used to with an auto loan or credit card or whatever. That's the message they need to know before they can vote on anything. Right. And we've seen it with the NEGREG, is, you know, the negotiated rulemaking processes, even through that process, which had a lot of good things and good discussions, you know, EICR is not the best of all the programs in any way. And I think that's because we need more leadership at the congressional level to come in and say, we want these benefits from these plans in this, you know, new plan. And that's just such a no-brainer, like you said. Until we have that kind of like push, I think we're gonna keep seeing what we've been seeing, basically.
Even when Congress does come in there, though, the proposal from the Republican senator that led the Education Committee in the Senate was basically to let people do like a 10% payroll withholding from their paychecks. And the funny thing with that is, who would that benefit? Business owners. Business owners could pay themselves an artificially low wage, and you could pay yourself like $120,000 a year as a dentist and make $400,000 a year and pay, you know, $800 a month on your student loans. And it's like any system they try to come up with has pros and cons. And like you said, you know, they deal with complex issues. So a lot of this stuff just isn't something that people are aware of or focused on. But let me ask one more question.
Sure.
What would you like our listeners to know next about Pay It Off?
Well, I think that what's important to know about Pay It Off, like if you're interested in checking out some of the tools that we offer, you can go to payitoff.io. There's a list of our partners there, apps that are using our technology. We have such an amazing team we've put together. We have someone who is leading product at Simple Bank and at Charles Schwab for a long time. Steph is our head of product. We've just got a killer engineering team that we've built over the past many years. And now we're really starting to scale this to institutions. And we've gotten a lot of financial institutions involved now. And we're trying to promote this within the financial services community. We're trying to get more borrowers into repayment, better borrower outcomes, so that we can save them billions of dollars. And I think those are our marching orders, you know, and I'm seriously a lifer in this. I don't know if you're feeling like this, but like, I am just like, this is just my, like, debt repayment is literally all I'm going to be thinking about for the next decade. So you know, as we start going into other debt verticals, it'll be interesting to see what those nuances are too.
Give me three more extensions and I'm going to tap out UFC style, you know, just take me off and throw me out of the ring. It's a fun thing to fix for people, but it is difficult to give people advice when things are just, oh my gosh, oh, they're my complicated. God. I don't know. Hopefully we'll have clarity. That's what I'm hoping for. Well, again, folks, if you're a financial advisor, financial institution, or you know somebody who's at a financial institution that could benefit from increased technology around figuring out student loans, check out payitoff.io. If you are a regular borrower, then maybe you will end up indirectly using some of Bobby's tools one day and not even realize it. So, Bobby, thanks so much for being on the show.
Thank you. Appreciate it, Travis. Appreciate everything you do.